at the end of those 2 years, I remember coming home to Mary Ann. It just happened to be 2 years. And I said, you know what? I think I like this business. She said, oh, my God, thank God. So it was the right decision, in this case, the right path. But I had to learn the right path. And, you know, I enjoyed it. It certainly, we've had some ups and downs like anybody's life or anybody's business. But, you know, again, I've learned a long time ago that, and it sounds almost like a cliche, but I live by the golden rule. I try to treat people like I like them to treat me. And that's served me pretty well.
You're listening to St. Pete X. Today's episode is brought to you by Cityverse. Cityverse brings the community together on a new civic platform powered by Catalyst News. St. Pete Cityverse is launching soon. You can learn more and reserve your home space at cityverse.life. Now, enjoy the conversation.
Joining me today on SPX is, amongst many other things, but one of the things we're talking about today is the author of a book, The Pathfinder, which is about your pretty considerable and wonderful life. Mark Mahaffey, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Good to be with you, Joe.
So in reading the book, the first thing that struck me is how do you remember all that? I mean, you had such detailed memories of your earliest childhood. I mean, some of the things certainly stood out, but what was that process like?
I've been asked that question quite a bit, and I do have a good memory. And the things that I talk about in the book, obviously, at least to me, were important to me as I was living them. And then as I recalled them, I'm very blessed. I have a good memory. And but ask me what I did yesterday, and I probably can't tell you.
All right. Well, and it sounds like, you know, one of the things that's certainly infused throughout the book is appreciation. And when you appreciate things, you tend to remember them more. And so maybe appreciation is part of the secret to remembering things.
Well, I thought about writing this book for several years. I made a couple of outlines, and then I sort of got stuck in the mud. Because one of my weaknesses is that I don't know how to type. I hunt and peck. And unfortunately, looking back, I wish I had taken typing in high school. But anyway, that's a slow process when you try to write a book. And fortunately, I found a wonderful woman that is the wife of my chief financial officer for our company. And she volunteered to see if she could help me. She had never written a book, but she'd done a lot of creative writing. And we made a great team. And so I was able to tell my stories to her, and she would tape me while we met, tried to meet once a week, usually on a Friday for about 2.5-3 hours. She would tape me and then take these copious notes that I couldn't dare look at her hands because I'd get dizzy watching her types. So she was very talented at sorting through those stories and then writing them up for me. And then I would look at the Word document that she would email me and go through each chapter. And so it was a good collaboration. So it really worked well.
So I really want to touch on a few of the themes. Well, I'd say the overarching theme is that you found a lot of meaning in your life and you seem to be satisfied with the meaning that you found in your life. And so I want to dig into that, but I want to kind of lead up to it. So certainly one important element of that is friendships, and a lot of your friendships you've had since, you know, playing basketball at the neighbor's house when you were, a young boy. Talk about how friendships have given meaning to your life.
Well, first of all, a lot of my life, if I reflected back on, and I think it's true of most everybody's life, it's all about relationships, the friendships that you make during your life. And so when I reflected back on my life, I started off the book by talking about hitchhiking to my high school, and then how I had made a very good friend in grade school and who taught me really how to play sports. And then when we entered high school, as sometimes happens in life, you drift away from that friendship or relationship, which happened to me. I mean, the friend I'm referring to in the book is Mike Johnson, and we remained least friendly, but he sort of took one path and I took another. And, as I described in the book, he was turned into be a little bit of a wild child and, never did anything real bad, but just sort of took a different route. And so that's when I met another friend that his name was Bob and last name was Desitel. And so I started playing basketball over at his house, which was probably a mile and a half away. And back then, of course, we weren't old enough to drive. I rode my bicycle over at Bob's house, and that was sort of the neighborhood house. There's always seems to be one. And that was Bob's parents were wonderful, and they ended up being my second parents. And, of course, that's where I met my future wife, unbeknownst to me, who is Bob's little sister, and ended up marrying her all those years later. It's funny, when we got to college, she was 3 years younger than I was. And I always thought I was very attracted to her. I thought, well, she was a cute girl, but her brother played big brother quite a bit of the way. So I didn't dare enter into that arena until one time I came home on a Navy Lee. I'd been gone about a year and came home just for a week or so and ended up being invited to my friend Bob's graduation down in Cincinnati. So when I went down there for that weekend, that's where the sparks hit between his sister Marianne and me, and that's where our so-called romance started. That was in 1967 in May. Went out with her during that weekend and that Sunday night. Anyway, I didn't see Marianne until December of that year, which is 7 months later. And then the next thing I saw her was at like in April of that following year, which was 1968. My parents came out to California to see me when I was stationed in the Navy out there on an aircraft carrier. And they could sort of see our relationship developing. And they said, do you want to invite Marianne to come out there with us? I said, oh, that'd be great, which it was. Our relationship really strengthened, and we knew that we thought we were meant for each other. But then I didn't see her. I went overseas on the aircraft carrier and didn't see her until the following late November when I came home on a unofficial leave for Thanksgiving. And that's when I ended up, after driving about 5.5 hours from Chicago to Indianapolis, where I lived. Anyway, it gave me a lot of time to think, and I had already decided that she was the woman that I wanted to be my wife, but I was going to wait till Christmas to ask her to marry me. Well, that long drive, I said, what the heck? I said, I'm going to ask her. So here I'm asking my best friend's younger sister to marry me, and that was about 2 o'clock in the morning that Thanksgiving Eve, and I'm not even sure Marianne was totally alert when I went through my humility speech. And so anyway, she said, happily, she said yes, and both families were very excited. And then we got married. I left again to finish my tour with the Navy and came back home late May of that year, which was 69, and we got married June 28th in 69. So that's sort of how that developed. And then about a month later, after our honeymoon, we moved to St. Petersburg, Florida, and I started working in the apartment business with my brother and my father. So,
well, and that's a good segue. Sometimes I'll get rolling on conversation without a proper introduction, and you say the apartment company, which is Mahaffey, which is responsible for, I say anything with the word arms at the end of it. You guys, you guys probably built it. Carlton Arms and, you know, what is now the Beacon in downtown, I think was your first big project in St. Pete, Beacon on Fifth. And that's the family business.
That's family business. And, back in 1962, I was just barely in college, and I had worked, as I talk about in the book, a couple of summers up in northern Michigan at a really nice restaurant. I worked as a waiter in that restaurant. And if anybody's seen Dirty Dancing, which sort of was in the Northeast, but it was very much like that. A lot of college kids, men and women, working hard, but also playing hard. So that was a great experience for me. It taught me a lot of things about people, how to talk to people, and how to, you know, deal with different situations. So I really appreciated those days. And I was asked to come back for the third summer, and I was very tempting. But my father asked me to consider, and I use the word consider because he was a strong individual, and he was smart enough to not just say, this is what you're going to do. He said, I want you to consider coming down and working with your brother and him in the apartment business, which was the Carlton Towers, and renting apartments. And I thought about it, and I finally made, as I look back on it now, I really made the right decision. Because it gave me an opportunity, first of all, to learn sort of the basics of renting apartments, but also gave me an opportunity to get to know my dad a lot more than I had in the past. And I was the youngest of four. My father was busy working up in Indianapolis while I was growing up. And certainly I saw them, but he wasn't the type of father that you know, tossed the football with you or even taught you how to play sports. He was working very hard, and I never begrudged that. It was just he was doing his thing. But here was an opportunity for me to come down and work for him. I sort of laugh in that we became roommates for 2.5 months at the Edgewater Beach Motel, which was a small motel down really on what is now part of the Vannoy grounds. It has a swimming pool, and it was well run, and it was owned by the Barger family, and so that's where we lived in a just a basically decent sized motel room for 2.5 months, just the two of us. So that really gave me an opportunity to really learn about my father, and my father to learn about me, and certainly learned quite a bit about renting apartments, and also just our personalities, learning about one another. So I cherish those days. So I did that for three summers, once in St. Petersburg, then over on the East Coast near Cape Canaveral. We were building a project over there, a development. And so I worked for my brother over there. And then the third summer, I worked half the summer back in St. Petersburg at the Carlton Towers, which was then all finished and just learning about management. And then I went on a midshipman cruise in the Navy. I went through NROTC at Notre Dame. And so between your junior and senior year, I went on a cruise to Little Creek, Virginia on an LSD, which stood for Landing Ship Dock, and for 6 weeks. And so that was my training, other than 4 years of NROTC at Notre Dame. So those experiences in Michigan, working at as a waiter as a really nice restaurant, alongside a really one of my best friends then and still is, Dick DeVore, as I describe in my book. But then coming down to Florida and working alongside my father and my brother. And so fast forward a bit, and I'm in the Navy for 3 years, which taught me so much. was on an aircraft carrier, and the way it works on an aircraft carrier or on any other ship, a Navy ship, you start off as a green, wet behind the ears ensign, and you work your way up. And on the aircraft carrier, I worked on the bridge along with other officers, and I eventually got promoted to officer of the deck, and I worked under a wonderful captain, Dan Murphy, who taught me so much about treating people, leadership. I'll never forget him. He ended up being a 4-star admiral, the only least back when I ended up visiting him later on in my life in Washington, D.C. He was the first 4-star admiral that did not go to the Naval Academy, which was quite an achievement. Anyway, he taught me a lot, and I'll never forget him. And so, again, getting back to what I think the theme of the book is, it's all about relationships.
So, dipping back into meaning, relationships obviously is a lot of what that boils down to. But I still want to look into some of the decisions that you made. Number one, military. So, how normal was it? You know, you came from an upbringing where you kind of could have done a different things. You know, you're obviously going to university, worked in the business. How unusual of a choice was it at that time for you to actually go into the military and serve?
Well, first of all, my dad went to Notre Dame, and so that certainly had an influence on the college I chose to apply to. And so anyway, I applied to Notre Dame and two or three other schools, and I was accepted to Notre Dame. And when my mother found that out, and she said, and she had done her research, this was back in 65, 66. No, I'm wrong about that. 62 is when I graduated from high school. So right around, you apply like you do today at the end of, toward the middle of your junior year. So we're talking about latter part of 1961, early part of 62. So I got accepted in the spring of 62 at Notre Dame, and she then, talked to me and said, I think it would be wise for you to apply for the NROTC program at Notre Dame. And I said, really? I said, so I looked into it, and being like, you know, 18 years old and looking forward to going to college, it was not at the top of my list to add that burden of taking, as it turned out, 3 more hours of class per semester plus 2 hours of drill per week. That was a lot of, and none of my friends were doing that, but I have to credit my mother with being very wise. I think she thought it would be good for the development of me into an adult. Also, I'm sure she was worried about the Vietnam War that was starting to percolate, and she was concerned about that, and rightfully so. She basically made it very clear she was really influenced me, and I'm sure I could have bucked that recommendation, but I decided, well, what the heck, I'll apply, and I was accepted. And as they say, the rest is history, because that she was right. It did develop me into an adult, taught me a lot of things. But basically, I went through 4 years of training at Notre Dame. And I remember when I graduated early June at Notre Dame, you also got commissioned as an ensign the next day. And so right around the end of May, I got my orders. I thought I'd have probably a month or 4 or 5 weeks. Well, I had a week. I had to go to, I was ordered to go to a weapons school in San Diego. The ship was home based in Long Beach, California. So I thought it was going to be a week school. As it turned out, when I got out there, it was not a week school. It was a 2-month school. And so, which I found out in no turnaround, I had to go through that, which was a good school. And it also wasn't that difficult, even though there was a full agenda, full syllabus, and but it was a for me, as I look back on it, it was a good sort of easing me into the military life. And so I ended up going to the ship in Spain, and that really almost 3 years on that ship, and went overseas to Vietnam twice. And we patrolled the waters and did search and rescue and reconnaissance off our carrier. And, you know, I learned a lot of leadership and certainly a great experience working with people alongside fellow officers, but also I had a division to run and the bridge watches, which taught me a lot. So I think back and I say to my mother, who is a spirit now, saying, thanks, Mom, because you steered me right.
And she was equally supportive even after the Notre Dame time ended of you staying on. And I guess the alternative might have been getting drafted into another area that wasn't quite as safe theoretically. And so by continuing down that path and serving on the aircraft carrier, you filled your patriotic duty, but it did so in a way that was kind of your choosing.
Well, it had, manyfold purposes, it turned out. And I think she really felt that. And I learned very quickly. And it's amazing because getting back into relationships and friendships, I made a lot of good friends out there. Still friends with several of the men I served with. And one in particular, and I talk about my friend Steve Betcher in the book, and that we've been friends for God knows how long, but since, I guess, 1967 when I first met him. And he's like a brother to me. And we've been through some thick and thin with one another. He now lives in Colorado, and we see one another quite a bit. And the families and the wives are very good friends. But it's really gratifying to form a friendship that many years ago and watch it flourish, and still great friends today.
And he had something to do with helping develop one of your leadership philosophies, which was to give people a chance to lead, because you proposed him to to work above his pay grade and man a shift under your supervision earlier than he would have been if he had followed the strict letter of the procedure. And that, that method of letting them sort of try leading a little bit early seemed to pay off, and they ended up adopting that program.
Well, when I was first promoted to officer of the deck, first of all, watch on an aircraft carrier, you normally have 3 to 4 officers on the watch. You have an officer of the deck, a junior officer of the deck, and then 1 or 2 junior officers of the watches. So back, I was still an ensign. I got word that I was being promoted to officer of the deck, and I went, oh, my God. And I moved up the sort of the chain from junior officer of the watch to junior officer of the deck, and the only reason I know I was named officer of the deck, and it was because of attrition. Somebody left, got out of the Navy, and I was so-called senior man with the most experience. Well, to be real honest, now and also back then, I went, oh, my God, I'm not qualified to do this. And so my first watch, we had some Russian trawler sort of shadow us, and it was 4:30 in the morning, which is supposed to be a very quiet watch. Well, I had to wake the captain and tell him that we have got a little situation out here. There's a Russian trawler that's on a collision course with us. So I practically got that sentence out, and the captain was standing next to me in his bathrobe saying, what's going on? So and that ended up okay. He was just trying to harass us. But the new captain, whose Captain Murphy, came aboard not too much farther along than that and let it be known that he didn't think I was quite qualified. Well, felt like saying, well, really? No kidding. So I hit the books somewhat and spent time talking to other officers that were qualified. And so took me a few weeks, but the captain let it be known that he thought I was qualified. So anyway, several months later, after serving time overseas at what they called Yankee Station, which was North Vietnam, we were then just going to back to Japan for a little off combat duty, I approached Captain Murphy and I said, I've got an idea. And he said, what? And he said, well, I like to pass it through. And I reviewed how sort of I got that job and got promoted when I really wasn't qualified. And I said, what I'd like to do is take the junior officer of the deck and have him make him the officer of the deck. And I'll be his junior officer of the deck. Officially, still I'm the officer of the deck, but let him run the watch for the whole 4 hours for hopefully a week or two. I'll still be there if anything that I have to step in, but I'll be his assistant, but I'll let him run it. And I said, I think we're going to qualify. I think we can qualify at least a few people that I think have the quality and but they just need the experience. And I said, I'd like to try that. Well, Captain Murphy said, you know what? I think that's a good idea. Let's give it a whirl. So we ended up qualifying four or five men, and one of which was Steve Betcher, who was the first one, and he qualified within a week with that system. And so anyway, I had one guy or one man that I wanted to try was sort of my last hurrah on this type of training. And I told the captain of that, and he said, well, I thought you sort of run through the gamut here. And I said, well, I've got one more. And he said, who might that be? And I told him the guy's name was Dorsey Morris, who was really a good guy, but very laid back. He was from Georgia and sort of have a lackadaisical manner or behavior, but I knew he was smart enough. He just needed to be pushed. And I said, I'd like to try it. And I'll be hard on him, but I think he can do it if you allow me to train this man. And he said, okay, you haven't been wrong so far. Let's give it a shot. Well, Dorsey did get qualified, even though I was really hard on him. And, but I think, I don't know whatever happened to Dorsey, but hopefully maybe I gave him the push that he needed to be a leader, and hopefully maybe that served him well in the rest of his life. I don't know, but I'm hoping that. But that taught me that, you know, if you give somebody a chance and also be there to try to assist him. So I installed that same kind of system with our managers, and it's been successful. We'll take an assistant manager on one of our developments and have that person sort of run the watch or be a manager, and let the real manager sort of stay in the background. And we have found that we really qualify competent people to become managers through that experience. And I brought that from what I learned in the Navy.
And that also means you need to have a culture of pragmatism, because a lot of managers will say in traditional, a traditional corporate structure might be a little more protective over their real estate and not wanting to give a chance for somebody to show them up, or, you know, they really have to be team players, take a step back to be, you know, even if it's just functionally the assistant and giving their folks a chance to shine.
Well, I found that, the managers that step back also feel, it seems to me, at least the way I look at it, they feel a sense of accomplishment that they have actually helped train somebody that really had the potential. And I think it served us well. So I'm very proud of that.
And so after this time on the boat, you had probably one of the bigger crossroads in your life, which was what's next. And you had intended on an MBA. Certainly the military was theoretically an option, career there. And that's when you got the call from your dad. Talk about the decision process, but what you were weighing as far as what you wanted your future to be and how much that played into that decision.
First of all, I'd worked for my father and my brother before, during my college years. My father was tough to work for. I knew that, even though I had gotten to know him quite well during that time. I was sort of in a quandary saying, well, do I want to go to school and get a graduate degree, just as a, I don't know, as a backup. But my father was very persuasive. He ended up being pretty, I think, very smart. He knew that if he tried to really coerce me or demand that I come down, that I think I've learned that being a parent also. You can just sort of lead the horse to the trough, but you can't make him drink. So he said he really appreciated me seriously considering it. And then he said, look, this is, he made the famous statement to me, which I knew it was my father saying it. He said, I can teach you more in 90 days than you'll learn in 2 years of grad school. And I sort of said, well, yeah, sure. And he said, well, let me say, he told me, he said, look, you went through a good business finance curriculum at Notre Dame. You've had 3 years good experience in the Navy. And frankly, we can really use your help right now. So I sort of said, okay, you know, I'm listening. And then my brother wrote me a tremendous handwritten letter, really telling me a lot more specifics of why he thought I ought to join them now instead of maybe joining them later. But then I went to see my commanding officer, and he told me, he said, look, and he'd already tried to influenced me on staying in the Navy. And I had told him why I wasn't going to do that. I said, look, I love the water, and but I don't want to. I said, you're an aviator. First of all, to be a captain of a aircraft carrier, you have to be an aviator. That's just part of the curriculum or the qualifications. So I said, you've had a good life. You haven't been to sea for 40 years. I mean, you sometimes go to sea, but not all the time. I said, because of my eyes, I don't have good enough eyes to be an aviator. I'd be in what they call black shoe Navy, which is ship Navy, versus brown shoe, which is aviator. And I said, that's just not for me. I want to have a family. So, you know, it's good for some people, but not for me. So he had already accepted that fact. So he told me, he said, if I were you, I'd go down to Florida for 2 years, and not any shorter than that. And you'll know by the end of 2 years whether it's something you really want to do. Or I think your father, who he had met, I think he wouldn't like it, but he'd accept it if you wanted to go a different route, either go back to school or do something different. So I, with all those ingredients, I decided, we're going to go to Florida. And so we did. And it was, I'll have to be the first person, and my wife, Marianne, would certainly echo these sentiments. It was a tough 2 years. It was a lot of adjusting, a lot of learning. And when I really got into the financial part of our business, as far as figuring out new developments, financing, dealing with that part of it versus just the management end, which is certainly a necessary ingredient that you have to do. But at the end of those 2 years, I remember coming home to Marianne. It just happened to be 2 years. And I said, you know what? I think I like this business. And she said, oh my God, thank God. So it was the right decision, in this case, the right path. But it was I had to learn the right path. And, you know, I've enjoyed it. It certainly, we've had some ups and downs like anybody's life or anybody's business. But, you know, again, I've learned a long time ago that, and it sounds almost like a cliche, but I live by the golden rule. I try to treat people like I like them to treat me. And that's served me pretty well.
You've mentioned a couple times that your dad was tough to work for. Can you break that down? How much of it was the nature of the business, and how much of it would you adopt, and how much would you, and what would you not adopt in how he was to work for?
Well, that's a good question. I first of all, when I came down, I was, my first job was at Carlton Arms of St. Petersburg, which we still own, which is on Pinellas Point. My father was sort of the philosophy of just throw him into the lion's den. And I think he, if I would have gotten gobbled up by the lions figuratively, he probably would have saved me, but he just sort of put me in charge and was certainly around, but, he let me learn that way, and I did, and it was tough in that I never knew if I was doing the right thing, but and then we got into a new development, which was Kokeneke Arms, and he really put me with a lot of responsibility as far as the beginning and the financing on that. He certainly was there looking over my shoulder, but and taught me at the same time, but also let me sort of make my own mistakes. Hopefully I didn't make too many. But that was the way he trained me. I wouldn't give those days up for anything because I learned so much. I remember standing in front of a pretty good crowd out on the island of Kokeneke talking to the neighborhood association, which there probably was 100 people in that meeting. And I had to get up and tell them what we were going to do on the south end of the island of Kokeneke. Fortunately, I had Carlton Arms, which we had already developed, which was only 2 miles away, to say, that's what we're going to do. We're going to build a Carlton Arms out on here, and we're going to be good community players and good neighbors, and we do what we say we're going to do. And so, as we ended up doing. So, you know, those experiences, I remember vividly. But here was this 25-year-old young, pretty young guy sort of put out there in front. But I learned a lot and I appreciated the way he taught me that way. By the way, I did learn in 90 days more than I would have lived.
How about your brother? So, you know, obviously he had been in the business before you by a couple of years. He was older than you by a couple of years. How did that, how smoothly did the division of labor sort of develop, and was there ever any kind of competition or whatever between you and him?
Well, my brother, Jim, he was 8 years older than I was. So he'd worked with my father up in Indianapolis in the finance company that our family owned. So he had a lot of experience with my dad. And then when my brother Jim and his family followed my father back in 1962 to come to Florida and develop the Carlton Towers and then later on other Carltons, I learned a lot from him, and he and I were certainly different, really different from one another. And we certainly had our differences. But we learned to work through those, and he was very smart, we both had both the same values, we worked together for a good long time. And he passed away in March of 2020. So I worked with Jim, you know, basically for 50 years, and we did a lot of neat things together. He was not certainly as outgoing as I turned out to be, but very, 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 as I said, smart, did a lot of neat things, and we built a lot of developments together. If I look back on it now, I think it was good that he was in Winter Park, especially when my father was in St. Petersburg. That worked out well, them having, you know, over 100 miles between them. And then I ended up being in St. Petersburg, and that probably was a good thing that we had separation. But, you know, I miss him. He was a good partner, certainly my brother and my friend. But, we worked together, but we also, stayed separated enough that it worked out.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, family businesses are tricky. They can go a lot of different ways. And it is worth noting that it's still a family business. And now your son and some of the other children of your brothers and sisters are have taken over the reins successfully.
Well, back in the end of 19, my brother and I decided that we would basically turn the reins over to my son, his son, and a son of one of my sisters. So, and I'm still involved, but those guys, they've been in the company several years, each one of them. And William Mahaffey, my brother's son, he's been in the business many years, and his talents are mainly focused on development, finding new pieces of land, working on the partnerships and the financing, etc. My nephew Dan, he's ahead of our construction division, and has been with that responsibility for a good many years. And my son Tom is more involved in management. And we now have 12 developments, working on number 12 right now, and that's in Winter Haven on Lake Dexter, which is a natural lake. And it's exciting that we still are developing future properties. They're now called the Carlton. Carlton Arms is a name we used over many years, and it's basically describes, at least in our mind, a two-story colonial style concrete block with a brick stucco facade, and a large piece of land, usually on water, either natural water or water that we make, meaning digging a lake, etc. So now we're building a three-story unit, actually also developing a four-story unit. We call that the Carlton. We're still like the name Carlton, which we think it's a good trademark, or it's a good label for us. Carlton is a name that my father thought years ago, back in the early 60s, that it was a classy name, a lot classier than Mahaffey. So it's not my mother's maiden name. It's a Carlton that he had stayed at a few Carlton hotels and just liked the name. So we've carried that name forward. And so my parents had 18 grandchildren, and we've had four that ended up being in the business with us. My son and two nephews and a niece who retired about a year ago. And that's amazing, because each sibling, me, my two sisters and my brother and I, ended up with one child in the business. And that was not by design. That's just the way it worked out. So we've had a few of those other grandchildren come and go, some easily, some not so easily. But again, Joe, you said it, a family business is a tricky business. It's, and we're fortunate that we've had the third generation come along that have the desire and the talent to keep going forward. And, so it's fun to watch. It's fun to watch for me to be still associated with the future, but certainly at, as they say, from 20,000 feet above.
And they're all sharing the same office.
Exactly. So, you know, it's been a good ride. My father started the business in Florida being really based on partnerships, which is, again, relationships, but partnerships. We've been in partners with several insurance companies, and their purpose was to provide good financing and certainly some knowledge, but we were the ones that created it, and they provided a good part of the financing or some of the upfront money. And we've partnered with some landowners that own the land. For instance, Coquina Key, we partnered with the Hardaway Company out of Columbus, Georgia, with their Mr. Hardaway, the president and some of his key people. We partner with J.W. Connor in Tampa on a big piece of land that we still are partnership with them. And so as of late, though, it's we certainly still have partnerships, but within our own family, number one, and also some key employees that own part of the pie, that's for sure. And we found that gives them some more incentive to they've always worked hard. We have good great people working with us. We've had some people work with us 40 or 50 years. It's unbelievable. But we feel, I think from the very beginning with my dad and certainly my brother and I, and now the third generation, we still go back to the good old golden rule. We treat people like we want to be treated and work hard, but enjoy life at the same time.
Let's talk about St. Pete and the St. Pete construction scene. So, you've been here through most of the changes. You've kind of seen it all with regards to how St. Pete has developed in the last few decades. Right now, there seems to be plenty of buildings happening, but a lot of higher end condominiums, high rises. Your model has always been different. It's always been a little more horizontal, two story, now moving up to three and four stories, but you've also tried to stay at a reasonable price point. And so, when you look at our affordable housing shortages today, where do you see yourself positioned and what do you think about the landscape of development in St. Pete today?
Well, I have been here a long time. You're right about that. And I've seen, when I first came to St. Pete in the early 60s and then, back in 69 when I came down to work on a permanent basis, the average age, even when Marianne and I came down here in 69, it was probably 68, 69 years old. Now it's 38 to 42. I mean, what a huge change in the demographics, which I think has been healthy for St. Petersburg. Marianne and I are real fortunate. We have three children, five grandchildren, and they're all adults now and have families of their own, but they all live in St. Petersburg. Now, we're not the usual case, but I'm saying we're not so unusual anymore because St. Petersburg's a great place to live and work. So we're blessed, and all three of our children and their children are here, but it's changed a lot. And Tampa Bay has become much more of a region than it was way back then. So getting to the housing, yes, you're right. There's a lot of, and a lot of these taller buildings you see coming out of the ground, yes, some of them are condominium, but also some of them are rentals. And I'm not sure which has the most, but are they affordable? Well, if you really look up affordable housing, they're not affordable. They're affordable for mid to upper class. And so, yes, affordable housing is a problem. And it's a problem we need to all address one way or the other. And we're certainly looking at that. We think we build affordable units for people. We try to keep the rents reasonable. But I think, the mayor is trying to, of St. Petersburg, Mayor Welch, he's trying his best is to try to, for instance, in the Tropicana and the gas plant area, trying to promote some affordable housing down there, which I hope works. We'll see how that works. It all depends on the incentives, all depends on the numbers, cost and financing. A lot of things go into that. But St. Petersburg is a great place to live. And I like the whole Tampa Bay area, obviously. And we have a lot of things going for us in this area.
Have you been tempted to go more upmarket in your development? And as you've looked at going the other way, as you've looked at affordable options from, with your developer's hat on, what is the best chance of success we have for creating the right the right mix of incentives for developers to do affordable? So, you've kind of played in the middle. Why haven't you gone either direction more?
Well, I think, now this is just what I think. What I would call a mixed development of, for instance, whether it be the Tropicana or the gas plant area or other places, if you can do a mixed, so there's some, we'll call it affordable housing mixed in with, other, we'll call it higher, not high, but middle income to higher income, a mixture. I've seen, at least in the past, developments that are, we'll just call them lower income developments in a total sense. I don't think that works. I really don't. I think if we can figure out how to do a good mixture, that works a lot better.
Do you think it's fair, you know, if you have a situation where you're going to build, you know, 100 units and make X amount, that it would be incumbent upon really the government to say, sure, you can build those 100 units, you can make a profit on 80 of them, but 20 of them you're going to make, you know, you're going to make break even so they can be affordable, or, you know, and this is just a crude way of saying it, but that, you know, the development still makes sense, even just making profit on 80, even if you're not making profit on 100 and you still get that affordable housing.
Well, back several years ago, the government had a tax exempt bond program that worked very well for a while, which we used. And I can't remember the exact rules, but it was pretty similar to what you just described, where maybe 20% of the units would be for in the definition of affordable housing. So there's got to be some incentive, at least from my point of view, to make it worthwhile where it makes sense as far as the profile of the residents, a real mixture, but also give some tax incentive one way or the other. So several years ago, it was tax exempt bonds. In other words, those were low rate bonds, which were tax exempt. From an investor point of view, they were very popular because an investor could buy those bonds that might be Pinellas County or St. Petersburg or even the state of Florida, which would give them tax exempt income and not have to pay taxes on. From the developer's point of view, that was a low percentage rate financing, which made it more plausible to build a development. So they have some programs that I really don't know enough about to even talk intelligently about there, where there's some tax incentive. But I don't know enough specifics to even describe them.
I'll finish up with a couple things. One, philanthropy. You've supported a lot of different causes, institutions, hospitals, Elon University, locally here, probably most known for the theater. So what has been the experience of having your name on that theater for so long? I know it was a gift you gave quite a few years back. You and your family gave each a portion of it to help revitalize it. You don't mention it a ton in the book, and it almost seems like something that is, has taken on a weird life of its own compared to everything else you're doing, where like, oh, people are talking about the theater again. Is there any truth to that? Am I reading that?
Well, the Mahaffey Theater, back in the mid 80s, back then it was the Bayfront Center, which included the theater and also, the arena. And so back in, let's say, the mid 80s, I'm guessing 84, 85, the city committee, including the mayor, came to me and said, would your family consider giving some substantial money for the theater to be upgraded? I mean, we were a portion of the money. And so we thought about it. I talked to my mother and my father and certainly my wife, because we had done some things in the past, but fairly quiet. And not with your name on a building. And the city first said, well, we'll just name the whole center after you. And we said, no, we don't want to do that. And they said, well, how about the theater? And so my mother always liked theater, Broadway and up in Indianapolis. We used to go to the theater and see plays and events like that. So she said, well, that might be an idea. And I always liked the theater. But it was still putting her name up in lights. And we thought about it for several months. And we finally decided, you know, we need to give back to St. Petersburg. This would help. We thought it would be a good catalyst or a good generator of making things come in downtown. So maybe that would help. And so we decided, yes, we'll agree. And we agreed to the money we were going to give them. And my dad gave, my mom and dad gave, the larger portion of our gift, and Marianne and I gave the other portion. And, over like a 5-year period of time, and they redid the theater, and we certainly had some say so as far as, We liked the idea of a European-style theater, and we liked the design and everything. So back in 86 or so, I think they opened the theater back, and it had the Mahaffey Theater name put on it, and they had a big opening, which was really a lot of fun. And then later on in the 90s, the city spent a good deal of money on the atrium part of the theater, and we're very proud to have our name on the theater, number one. And number two is it's been the catalyst that we would hoped it would be. And it's a jewel, you know, it's a cherished jewel.
And you got a little bit into the some of the operations with the support with the your foundation. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of relationship?
Yeah, I've Marianne and I have supported, some events and tried to help Bill Edwards in his operation of the theater. But Bill runs it. The city owns it. Our family name is on it, but certainly we've participated in some events down there, and we'll continue to do so.
And speaking of Bill and St. Pete changing, we have a foundation and connected to different development officers and things like that. And they really say that, you know, there's sort of, a group of folks that'd be you, Bill, Semler, Tom James, you know, sort of that have really given a lot of the support that the city has needed to get to where it's gotten, and that there isn't that following on, you know, generation of supporting figures like that. Have you felt that at all, where you're like, you know, have you had those conversations with some of the other people that kind of run in that circle where it's not getting replenished like it probably should?
Well, and also the Huff family.
Huff family, yep.
Should be included in that. Sure. List. They've done a tremendous amount of community service and philanthropy. So, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, we're still involved with the city, and so is Tom and Mary James, and Mel Semblers, and he and his wife have passed on, and we miss them dearly. But there's some, I think those families still will be involved as ours will be, but we need to look for new families, to be real honest about it. And I think they're out there, and maybe we can help in that regard as far as promoting, philanthropy from our city, because we have some really good families here that I think will step up.
Well, and you know, and the one thing, through everything you've been through, Marianne has been by your side, that is not the norm nowadays. You know, people come in and out of relationships much more frequently, and you've stood the test of time. I'd like to finish with you talking about what role and what she's meant to you in being your sort of partner in life.
Well, my wife, Marianne, has put up with me for almost 55 years. And one of the things I didn't mention, that she sort of laughs at, but it's true. When I did ask her to marry me, I went through this humble speech, which I don't think she was paying that much attention, because it was 2:00 in the morning, Thanksgiving Eve. But I told her it wouldn't be boring. I promised her that. And she remembers that, and she agrees it hasn't been boring. She, you know, we've been through, as most families, most couples, you have ups and downs in your life. And I talk about a few of those in the book. She's a very strong woman, and I'm lucky to have her as my wife. She's now gone through a cancer situation where a little over a year ago she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, which, as we all know, is one of the worst cancers. Fortunately, because she had some digestive problems earlier, meaning 2 or 3 years of trying to figure out what was going on with her. And over a year ago, they ran her gastroenterologist, Dr. Heidi Goldberg, ran some additional tests, and that's where the pancreatic problem came up. The interesting story there is that happened right before Christmas of 2022. And we were fortunate to have some relationship and some history with All Children's hospital here in St. Petersburg, which now is the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And we reached out to them for help. Fast forward, less than 30 days later, January 12th, Marianne was operated on in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins by their best surgeon and had half her pancreas and all of her spleen taken out. And then since then has had 6 months of chemo treatment at Moffitt Center in Tampa, both of which are fine institutions, and we were fortunate enough to be able to connect with them. But Marianne's spirit and her determination, I always knew she had that, but it's really shown its true colors in this type of situation, in that her optimism, again, her determination, her spirit, she's gotten through this, and now we're on the cycle where you have a CT scan every 90 days, and she just had one in December, which was all clear. So the outlook looks good, but I'm a firm believer, number one, in prayer, number two, in attitude and determination and some luck involved, that's for sure. So we're hoping for the best. We're optimistic, but she's been my rock. And I've been through some health issues, and my kids are very strong, all three of them, and they've helped me when I had some problems, and have helped her immensely. So it's a family deal, you know. It's all about relationships, love, prayer, and determination. So we're looking forward to the future.
The book is The Pathfinder, Finding the Right Path. It's available on Amazon. I enjoyed reading it. A lot of reasons to read it. There's some great St. Pete stories in there. If you live in St. Pete, you'll get a lot of value of understanding Mark's and his family's contribution, as well as just how something's rolled. And I found it great. So thanks so much for coming in. I really enjoyed the conversation. Again, I marvel at how quickly, in every question I give you, your recall and sharpness and details. You got a special brain in there. So that's nice.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed being here.